Well, go ahead and turn in your Bibles to the book of Exodus this morning. The book of Exodus, it's Genesis, then Exodus. So right away in the first half of the Bible. This morning we're starting a new sermon series through the book of Exodus, which I've entitled, The God Who Makes Himself Known. The God Who Makes Himself Known. But before we get going too far, I have to be honest with you that I've stolen that title. It's not original with me. It's actually from W. Ross Blackburn, who has written a very helpful resource within a series called the New Studies in Biblical Theology series. It's edited by a guy named D.A. Carson, if you've heard of him before. And it goes by that very title, The God Who Makes Himself Known. And it's a resource that I hope through this study over the next several weeks, several months, as we dig into the book of Exodus, that I'll share from, because I believe he hits the nail on the head as it relates to the main theme within the book of Exodus, and I'll share that with you shortly. But before we get there into the main theme in Exodus chapter 1, I want to begin by laying a backdrop for the book of Exodus. If you are in Exodus chapter 1 and you look down on that page right there, in our English translations, unfortunately what you won't see there is the very first word in the book of Exodus. And if you're reading from the English Standard Version, the CSB, NIV this morning, you'll find the word these. If you're reading from the King James or the NASB this morning, NASB, you have now these. But the book of Exodus actually begins with the word and in the original Hebrew in which Exodus was first written. Of course, all of the English teachers are happy that the book doesn't begin with and because you're not supposed to start a sentence with the word and. Nevertheless, understanding that this book starts with the word and immediately alerts us to the fact that what we're about to read is a continuation of a bigger story. You see, the book of Exodus is actually part two in a five-part series on the story of Israel. A series that has been commonly known as the Torah, the Law, or the Pentateuch, five volumes. And it's within these five volumes, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, that the author, Moses, who we will be introduced to next week in chapter 2, tells a story that has no shortage of dramatic moments and plot twists. But this is not just any story that he's sharing in these five books. This is his family story. Now, whether or not we want to accept it, each one of us has a family story. Some of our family stories contain a certain level of excitement and suspense. Others seem rather dull and boring. Whatever the case, each of us has a family story, and it's usually the topic of discussion at family reunions, weddings, and even certain holidays like Thanksgiving and Christmas. Some of you might not even know how innate your family story is for you until someone finally ask you, hey, share with me your family story. The reality is there's certain elements in all of our lives and our life as a family that have resulted from various events and experiences you and your loved ones have had in the past. Thus, our family stories create a certain cultural fabric for our family. For instance, some of you may already know this about my immediate family, but there is a deep-seated love for Little Caesar's pizza in our family. Yes, that is very strange, isn't it? Especially we love Little Caesar's on Christmas Eve. In the Loggins home, each Christmas Eve, we have that high-quality Italian-like pizza pie waiting for us as we come home from the Christmas Eve service. And don't forget those Olive Garden wannabe breadsticks, affectionately known as Crazy Bread. For my family, those two things are a must for Christmas Eve. I mean, we go to almost any extent to make sure that our family has Little Caesar's pizza and Crazy Bread on Christmas Eve. We even check a couple days beforehand to make sure they aren't closing earlier this next year than they had the previous year. What is this pizza insanity all about? Well, the history behind it is actually all the way back the Christmas Eve of 1978 when my parents were newly married and they decided to have Little Caesars for dinner on Christmas Eve. As most young married couples tend to do that first year of marriage, tradition was formed. And so that kept on going and going and going and has been passed on to the next generation. It's part of our family story, you could say. And although the pizza hasn't necessarily gotten any better since 1978, our memories around those slices of pizza create a certain nostalgia for our family, especially my sister, who loves the tradition and will, again, she's the one that goes to most of the extents to get that pizza. It's part of our family story. It's part of our fabric as a family. Well, here in Exodus chapter 1, Moses is picking up his family story from the book of Genesis. The end of Genesis hinted that a sequel was about to come. And so when Moses picks up part 2 here, he begins with verse 1 with the same exact words that we find in Genesis chapter 46 and verse 8. These are the names of the sons, or Genesis says descendants, of Israel who came into Egypt. But it's important for our understanding of not only this chapter, but of really the entire book, that we know what Genesis then is all about. And so I want to quickly highlight some of the important, significant parts of Genesis. If you're new to studying the Bible and haven't read Genesis yet, Genesis begins in chapter 1 with the account of creation. God, who has always been, gives form to heavens and the earth. He speaks light into existence with a word, and it was. He separates the light and darkness. He creates day and night. He separates the water under the expanse from the waters above, and he calls the expanse heaven. The waters underneath the heavens he gathers together, and he lets dry land appear, and he calls it earth. The waters he calls seas. He calls forth vegetation, plants, fruit trees from the earth. He creates seasons and days, the sun, moon, and stars. Then God created living creatures. Creatures that fly above. Creatures that swim in the waters and move on the land. All the beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And then, at the climax of his creative work, God creates mankind in his image, after his likeness. And he does so for a purpose, to have dominion over all his creation. And so he creates male and female, blesses them, and commissions them to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth and subdue it. And then the seventh day happens, and God rests. The beginning of the story seems all good. In fact, after creating mankind, God says it's very good. But as we continue through the story takes an unexpected twist in chapter 3 of Genesis. When the sinless humans God had created rebel and disobey his simple command to not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Instead of obeying their good and loving creator, they listen to the lie of Satan, who is in the form of a crafty serpent. And then, because of mankind's disobedience, death begins. The serpent is cursed above all creatures and is doomed to crawl on its belly and eat of dust all of its days. Enmity is placed between Satan and mankind, and God makes this promise that one day the woman's offspring will bruise his head, that is Satan's head. The woman and man also receive a curse. God tells the woman that she'll have pain in childbearing, that there'll be friction in the relationship between man and woman, pain and sweat and working the ground for food, and ultimately, death. Then God separates mankind from his presence in the garden, yet in his grace, before they leave the garden, he clothes them by the sacrifice of one of his creatures. Mankind and God are now at odds. The story begins with them together, but now they're separated. So as the story continues to unfold, all we hear and read about is this brokenness of mankind. A brother kills another brother in anger and jealousy. Every intention of the thoughts of the heart of mankind are only and always evil. And so God sends a flood to blot out his creation. Yet again, in his grace, he preserves Noah and his family, and he makes a covenant to never again flood the earth to destroy mankind. The story starts to look like it's going in the right direction again until Noah's descendants, in their arrogance, decide to build this tower in order to make a name for themselves. But God would not have mankind make a name for themselves and get glory for themselves, and so he confuses their language and scatters the people over all of the face of the earth. So we have brokenness once again. But God is still active. His grace and mercy continue, and he chooses a man named Abram to make a great nation from, a people who are to be a blessing in whom God says all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And so it looks like things are headed in the right direction again. This family story continues. But there's a problem. Abram and Sarai, his wife, are unable to have children. And so God reminds him of his covenant once again, that Abram's offspring will be as many as the stars in heaven. And finally, Abram believes. God blesses Abram, who's now given the name Abraham, and Sarai, now named Sarah, with a child named Isaac. As the story continues, Isaac and his wife Rebekah, who also happens to be barren, God again gives his grace and allows them to conceive and give birth to two twin boys named Esau and Jacob, who God explains will be two nations who will be divided, and one will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. Again, the suspense starts to build in this family story with Esau and Jacob. And soon we find out deception, instigated by the mother, Rebekah, brings the birthright to Jacob rather than who it was supposed to be for, Esau. And this division takes place between these twin brothers. Jacob ends up fleeing for his life. But interestingly enough, the remainder of Genesis focuses on this lying deceiver named Jacob. Jacob, who himself then is shortly tricked. Remember that part of the story? He's tricked into marrying the ugly sister when he was supposed to marry the beautiful one. But finally, he is given Rachel as his wife. Despite all of the mess that's going on in this family story, God blesses and renames Jacob Israel, reminding him of the covenant given to his grandfather Abraham. And again, we see God's grace in the midst of brokenness. Finally, in Genesis chapter 37, we're introduced to one of Jacob's sons, Joseph. It was a son that Jacob loved the most, more than any of his other sons. And so he gave him special treatment. This, however, as most of us would expect, and if it was the case for my brother, it would not sit well with his brothers. And so the brothers conspire against Joseph, and they soon sell him into slavery. And in the end, lie to their father that Joseph had been killed by a wild beast. Now, this is some story now. This is really getting exciting. And it's a messed up family, isn't it? Over and over throughout this book, we see a messed up, broken family. But this is where the story connects to what we're about to read here in Exodus chapter 1. Joseph initially finds favor while in slavery in Egypt, but then is wrongfully accused and thrown into prison. He is there in prison until finally God allows him to correctly interpret the Pharaoh's dream. And as a reward, Joseph is placed as second in command in all of Egypt. While Joseph is given prominence in Egypt, his family in Canaan is suffering through famine in the land. But then in a twist of fate, Joseph's brothers come to his feet begging for food. And Genesis closes as Joseph brings his family into Egypt for safety and protection. And we hear these words from the lips of Joseph to his brothers that ring in our ears. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Genesis closes with these words. And this is the story of Israel, part 1. 50 chapters in roughly 8 minutes. A story of brokenness, deception, darkness. Yet throughout it we see God's deliverance, his grace again and again. And as the story continues within this book of Exodus, part 2, what we'll begin to see is that this is not only Israel's story, but it's also our story. For our story is one of deliverance from darkness as well. So as we pick up here in verse 1, all the backdrop of Genesis has had a profound effect on the family of Israel and all that is about to take place. And so we read, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, all the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. And remember why he was already in Egypt. The guys we just read sold him. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Some 400 years have passed since Jacob and his sons entered Egypt. And with each passing year, the darkness only seems to get darker and more dismal for this family. As a result, the people of Israel have grown more and more desperate for deliverance. And it's in these pages in front of us that God not only delivers his people, but he makes himself known to his people. As this is, as W. Ross Blackburn notes, the central theme and theological concern of Exodus, that God's missionary commitment to make himself known to the nations. And so the book of Exodus shows us God over and over and over again. It is God's missionary commitment throughout the book of Exodus to make himself known, not only to his people, but as we'll see, to all nations. And so this morning, as we step into Exodus chapter 1, what I believe we see here is that God reveals his providence over his people. In the midst of darkness, God faithfully preserves his people for their good and his renown. That is the big idea this morning, that in the midst of darkness, God faithfully preserves his people for their good and his renown. The problem, however, for both the Israelites here in Exodus, and really for us today, is that the darkness often is just so deep that the light has been obscured and is seemingly concealed. In those moments of darkness, it's as if we have blinders, so we're unable to discern the fullness of God's story and grace and care. We tend to forget his goodness in the past because we're overwhelmed with pain in the present. But a significant part of our family story reminds us that God delivers and God cares. God preserves through famine. He protects through affliction, and he prospers through fear. And so as we study Exodus chapter 1 this morning, may we trust God's sovereign hand of providence in our pain by remembering his providence in our past. Moses begins this book by reminding us that God has preserved his people through famine. After recounting the family members who initially come into Egypt due to the famine in the land of Canaan in verse 1 through 6. In verse 7, Moses points out something rather notable. Now look down at verse 7 once again. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. 400 years earlier, it looked as if famine would totally wipe out this family of Israel. But now, in God's providence, we see that he has preserved his people and he has kept his promise. Notice that Moses here is emphasizing, by using certain language, the promises of God that are being fulfilled and preserved from Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 12. We see these words fruitful and multiply. Again, back in chapter 1 of Genesis, in verse 27, we see be fruitful and multiply. And the phrase, the land was filled with them. So what is happening to the people of Israel, who are now refugees in Egypt, is not only this fulfillment of the creation commission to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, but also a carrying out of the covenant that God had made to Abraham, that he would make of him a great nation. This is coming to pass right here as God's people have been brought into Egypt. The Hebrew literally reads, as for the Israelites, they grew, they were fruitful, they swarmed, they increased, they got powerful more and more, and the land was filled with them. And the point made by such language, notes Douglas Stewart, is that Israel's amazing population growth was the result of God's original design and his ongoing care. So despite the darkness and the reasons why they had to be taken into Egypt, despite Joseph being sold into slavery, and then the family happening to come because of famine, God is at work. God preserves his people. The darkness is overwhelming, but God is remaining true to his promise. Despite loss of food initially, and then eventually, as we'll see, a loss of their freedom, God was preserving his people for a purpose, as we'll soon see, to make himself known. Well, as Moses continues the family story, in verse 8, the darkness only increases, but he shows us that God has protected and will protect his people through affliction. The darkness increases throughout the chapter, and we begin to feel the pain of the people of Israel. Not only Joseph, his brothers, and all within that generation have passed on, but with their passing has come the passing of the king who rewarded and welcomed Joseph and his family. Now there is this new king over Egypt, a king who did not know Joseph. And as verse 9 through 10 tell us, that is increasingly troubled about these Israelites, this family that is here in his country. And so he sets out to protect himself. Look at verse 9. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." You see what Pharaoh is doing here. He's creating a certain narrative that says if they aren't careful as a country, the people of Israel one day decide to join forces with the enemies. And when that will happen, the downfall of the Egyptian empire will take place. He's basically saying you can't go straight to physical violence. You have to start setting a tone early on, and in the end, or if in the end, you'll get wiped out. And so this is a certain type of political shrewdness that Pharaoh has here. But as history shows, when there is political shrewdness, and when that persists, it always moves towards oppression and physical force. So that's exactly what happens in verse 13. It's not enough to say, "Be careful of the Israelites." No, he says, "So they ruthlessly or violently made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service." So the caution wasn't enough. He goes on to move to affliction. But notice in the midst of this severe affliction, what happens? They are being ruthlessly made slaves, bitter with hard service. But look at verse 12. "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad." That's not supposed to happen. That's not in Pharaoh's plan. That's not what's supposed to take place. In the midst of the hard, bitter service, they're supposed to die off quicker. But they multiply and spread abroad. And we see that God protects his people and the fulfillment of his promise, that they would be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, that there would be this great nation who would bless all people. Pharaoh's plan to control the population of Israel backfires, because God's providence prevails. Nevertheless, as we will see throughout the first half of this book, Pharaoh presses down harder. He presses down harder on the people in order to protect himself. And this leads us to our third point this morning. Moses reminds us that God prospers through fear. God not only preserves through famine and protects his people in the midst of affliction, he prospers through fear. Obviously, Pharaoh was infuriated by the fact that the people of Israel continue to multiply and increase. That is not what's supposed to happen. And so his next plan to get the Israelites is to destroy themselves. If I can't keep them from increasing, then surely they can keep themselves from increasing, he must have thought. In his frustration, the plan he unfolds reveals not only the extent to which he is willing to go to stop the Israelites, but it also reveals the darkness of the human soul and the rebellion that we have seen throughout the story so far, as people turn away from the good and loving Creator and they desire their own glory. Pharaoh is not only willing to enslave the Israelites, torture them with hard, bitter labor to control their population, but now he turns, in verse 15, to some secret manipulation in this form of state-sponsored genocide. And he does so by demanding the Hebrew midwives, specifically two women, Sapphira and Pua, I think I'm saying it correctly, not sure, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, to kill all the male Hebrew babies during the course of their birth. Matt Chandler comments, this here is a special kind of crazy. There's your normal crazy leader, dictator-like, then there's a kind of dark crazy, and then there's let's kill all the baby boys kind of crazy. This is disgusting and dark. Yet just how repulsive and sordid Pharaoh truly is yet to be fully seen. He demands that all the babies, male babies, be killed. But standing in his way is the God of the universe, who the midwives fear more than Pharaoh. Look at verse 17. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. Despite what punishment might have come, these two women decide not to listen to the king. Why? Well, simply because they feared God. They held him in higher awe, higher reverence and respect than the ruler of the superpower of their day. Tim Chester writes, they so trusted him to keep his plan, that is God, that they were prepared to defy those of Pharaoh. Their reverence and respect for God's authority outweighed their fear of Pharaoh. And in response to the king's questioning of their disobedience, they inform the king that the Hebrew women are just too vigorous and give birth before the midwife can come to them. Now, whether or not this is a lie from these two midwives, there's support that this is not a lie. In the end, we notice that God deals kindly with these two women. He does so by prospering not only all of Israel, but also these ladies specifically by giving them families. It was said that most Hebrew midwives were unable to have children, and so that's why they served the family as the midwives. But here, because of their fear, their reverence for God, God deals well, verse 12:20 says. God dealt well with the midwives. And not only the people multiplied, but because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. God prospered his people. And again, Pharaoh's plan backfires. Even though chapter 1 here is drawing to an end with the people of God flourishing in numbers and strength, the chapter closes out in verse 22 with the final assault from Pharaoh against God's people. Again, his anger is so fierce and unchecked that we see the true nature of his sordid self. He commands the entire nation of Egypt to throw every son born to the Hebrews into the Nile River. If the midwives won't do it, then I will do it myself. I'll set a decree that every Egyptian in this nation, when he sees an infant boy, should throw them into the river. The river of the Nile is where everyone lived in Egypt, and so this would be convenient for everyone. This act of genocide would be convenient for all of the Egyptians, and it would have likely been viewed as an act of obedience to the God of the Nile. The God of the Nile was the one that the Egyptians saw as the giver and taker of life, and so Pharaoh even craftily sets this aside and almost shifts the blame. This won't be me being blamed for the death, but the God of the Nile be blamed for the death. Again, we feel the weight of darkness in our family story. The weight of darkness over the people of Israel. God's kind hand of providence, though, has been undeniable throughout this chapter. God delivers his people from out of the darkness. And so, as the screen fades out and the words "to be continued" appear, we might wonder, will God remain faithful? Will he continue to preserve his people? The darkness is just so overwhelming here. But the past answers, Well, he has proven his faithfulness time and time again. God has preserved his people through famine. He's protected his people through affliction and oppression. He has prospered them through fear. And this is our God. This is our story. In the midst of darkness, God faithfully preserves his people for their good and his renown. Where does this story connect with ours? Well, I love this quote from Charles Spurgeon, which I believe sums up what we see here in Exodus 1 and connects it to our own stories. God is too good to be unkind, says Spurgeon, and he is too wise to be mistaken. And when we cannot trace his hand, we must trust his heart. When you cannot trace his hand, you can trust his heart. How? How? How do we trust his heart when we cannot trace his hand? By looking to the cross. To the one who has taken our brokenness and suffering upon himself. We can always see Christ dying for our sin as the objective evidence that he is for us and not against us. He has made a way for us. The family story will continue all the way to the birth of one in the manger in Bethlehem, who blesses all nations, who is the offspring of Abraham, who is preserved throughout the story. And yet this one, this perfect Son of God and Son of Man, will suffer loss in our place. He will face the fiercest oppression and affliction on our behalf. And yet he will overcome death and the grave for us. So that Paul would write at the end of Romans 8, "What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Pharaoh can't be against us. We've seen it in the past. He tried, but he cannot be against us. He, that is God, who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? Who shall bring any charge against God's elect? It's God who justifies. Who is to condemn? Christ Jesus is the one who died, more than that, who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who indeed is interceding for us. Who shall separate us then from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or danger, or sword? No, Paul writes, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers nor heights, nor depth nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord." You see, the kind providence of God is seen in the face of Christ, who takes upon himself our pain and our darkness and delivers us. Friend, do you know the love and care of God through Jesus Christ? If not, come to faith in Jesus today and experience his deliverance from darkness. As we read, he delivers us from the darkness, the domain of darkness, and transfers us into the glory and the beauty, the light of his Son. This is our story. Delivered from darkness to light. Born in 1731 in Berkhamsted, England, William Cooper's mother died when he was only 6 years old, leaving him to be raised by his father. His life would be marked by periods of intense depression, leading him to attempt suicide on several occasions. But while in residence at St. Albans Insane Asylum, after one attempt to take his life, Cooper happened upon a Bible on a bench in the garden, and God used John 11 and Romans 3:25 to open his eyes to the goodness of Jesus and the sufficiency of his atoning work. Throughout the rest of his life, he remained convinced of God's sovereignty and goodness. even though at times he had great difficulty believing he himself was a beneficiary of them. In 1767, Cooper moved to Olney, England, and soon became friends with John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace. Cooper began hymn writing as a result of this friendship, and in 1774, he wrote what is thought to be his last hymn, containing these profound words: God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable mines of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. You see, in the midst of darkness, God faithfully preserves his people for their good and for his renown. And so, friend, when you cannot trace his hand, know you can trust his heart. So, Father, this morning, I pray that that would be true of each and every one of us. That in those moments of darkness and pain, when all life seems to be swirling around us in torment and affliction and oppression and loss and danger, that you would be the steady and sure anchor that we can trust your heart. That you are for us. That nothing can separate us from your love in Christ Jesus. And so, Father, this morning, we declare as your people that you are sovereign over us. And while there are questions in our minds, we still trust. When we don't know what you're doing, we hold to your hand and know that you hold us fast. Thank you for your grace. Thank you for this portion of the story. It's not just a story far removed from us, but it's our story, for you deliver us from darkness.